You are listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at KFAI.org. I'm Josh Weber, and tonight on Right on Radio, Annie Harview talks with Renee Lenore Hansen, author of Watershed, Attending to Body and Earth in Distress. Hansen has taught writing and global studies at Minneapolis College for 31 years. Watershed is a meditation on intimate connections between bodily health and biome health. She weaves experiences in the northern watersheds of Minnesota with stories from her students and from her type 1 diabetes diagnosis.
And I'm Dave Fettig. In the last part of the hour, our superstar host Annie will conduct yet another interview with the author Maggie Shipstead to discuss Great Circle, a novel. Epic and emotional, meticulously researched, and gloriously told, Great Circle is a monumental work of art and a tremendous leap forward for the prodigiously gifted Maggie Shipstead. All of this and more, so stay tuned to Right on Radio.
Hi, Renee. It's so great to have you in the studio.
Well, hello. It's super wonderful to be here and live, actually.
Yeah, y'all, this is my first guest in person in over a year.
Wow.
Renee is a local author, and I was so excited when she was vaccinated and was able to come in. There's something so special about being able to talk to someone in person and, like, show them our studio space. It's really
a treat. And see real smiles, not just eye smiles.
Yeah. So let's start talking about your book. Let's just dive right into it. So today we're talking about Watershed, Attending to Body and Earth in Distress. For those who haven't got their hands on the book yet, could you briefly describe what this book is about and read folks a little sample?
I'm going to read from sort of the second introduction or something like that. It's got a lot of little parts in it. This is called How to Live, which is pretty audacious. I just say in the notes that I don't really know, but this is the best I can do, and please write your own. There's a whole blank page opposite this for you to write yours. I think this explains somewhat. Climate catastrophe turns up in my body and in yours. As the climate shifts, basic life processes alter. Spring and summer, fall and winter, air and ocean currents, atmospheric density. As the climate continues to change, the new patterns, to which we may have attempted to adapt, begin to swirl. Lyme disease extends its reach as the landscape warms. I got a different one last summer, and it wasn't Lyme, but there's all kinds of tick diseases now spreading. Anyway, I didn't write that. Diabetes, in both its forms, is increasing on all continents at a rate faster than any previous human disease. Climate change will complicate the management of diabetes. Water shortages, outdoor conditions that make exercise difficult, pollution, novel viruses, infrastructure instability, too much or too little or inappropriate food, all will make diabetes and other illnesses harder to contend with. Some of these conditions will further increase the number of people with disease. Paradoxically, living in a damaged body can teach us much about how to live in a damaged ecosystem and about how to return to practices of joy. And that's why I wrote it, because I was distressed about ecosystem destruction.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow this miracle of diabetes helped me become more comfortable with it.
Yeah. And I love, just to elaborate on that for a moment, about things I especially appreciated. I love how you kind of take folks through the journey of not really knowing you have diabetes, but knowing you have various, like, mystery discomforts and problems, to kind of interacting with the kind of clunky and frankly kind of dangerous gaps in healthcare for people,
yeah.
Like having limited strips, being somewhere and needing something you don't have, through to making those connections between continuing to care for an ailing body and continuing to care for an ailing environment. And I was just wondering, because this concept, I immediately was interested in this book because, of course, many people rightfully are writing about climate change these days, but I'd never seen it compared to a co-narrative that's so personal and that's so focused on one's own body. I feel like there's a lot of dialogue about improvement of the world is about very explicitly, like, ascetic, like, self-sacrifice.
Yeah.
Just this concept taught me a lot about diabetes, but it could also be helpful for anyone wondering about anything. And it's kind of, again, for those who haven't read, it combines a personal narrative and interactive advice, ideas, meditations. Like Renee mentioned, there are some places and spaces where you're welcomed to think about things as they apply to your own life. Did you have an envisioned reader, whether like a real specific group of people or kind of someone more hypothetical in mind when you wrote this?
I think that the first reader that I would think about would be my students and my children.
Uh-huh.
Because I was shocked to have students come back to me and say, my parents won't talk about climate change to me.
Oh.
They say, I'll be dead then, so I don't care, or something like that. And
oh.
I'd look at the student and say, you were right there? They said that with you there?
And they're like, you don't get a planet. Bye.
No, it doesn't. And I realized that parents were probably traumatized too, but
yeah,
it feels really wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to be there with whoever is facing this. And it's of course happening right now. It's not just in the future. It's yesterday. It was literally hot and humid. And
yeah,
my nephew just lived through fires in Arizona. And, you know, it's all around. And I can't be with all of them, but I can at least tell them I care and have thought of them.
Yeah.
So that's much of what I thought about. And then just frozen you can get when mm-hmm. you deal with a big, big issue like this.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to know how to move. And I thought that if life could give me any words that would help other people find their next step
mm-hmm.
or their next word, I would like to do that. So anyone who will join me in that conversation would be the reader.
That's really wonderful. I love how this book kind of just unrelentingly joins those conversations that many are averse to having, like about problems in the healthcare system, about climate change, and you're allowing all of these conversations to run parallel and kind of intertwine, even though they could seem radically different. Like, mm-hmm. as I mentioned, I've never before seen a book that's about diabetes and climate change. Could you tell me a little about how you structured and organized the book so the things weave together but also have their own space?
Yeah, and another thread that I think is important to put into that is climate justice and refugee status,
mm-hmm.
that I was not aware until students taught me that the Somali war started from climate disruption,
mm-hmm.
that it was not just that people couldn't get along. And mm-hmm. You know, there's this attitude like refugees are here because they couldn't handle things at home. Well, they couldn't handle things at home because everything died because of climate change.
Mm-hmm.
And that that was a really big motivating message to me. And students coming to me saying, you please tell the people you know, you're asking us to tell people, which I was, please write it, tell it, keep saying it.
Mm-hmm.
But they said, you need also to tell people because you've got access to some people we don't.
Yeah.
And as a Minnesotan, been here my whole life, and mm-hmm. I'm outstate almost more than city,
mm-hmm.
I do have people who might be willing to listen to me that my students don't yet have access to.
Yeah.
It didn't exactly answer your question. It was something about how you weave the strands, but I'm going to go to that.
Yeah.
I wrote the different parts at different times and in different places.
Cool.
We were talking ahead of time about writing practice, and mm-hmm. one of the things that's important to me is the place where I write.
Yeah.
Because the place comes through the writing.
Mm-hmm.
So when I wrote my love song to Minnesota, Watersheds, mm-hmm. I was up north in the home that I grew up in, right outside of, right on Birch Lake, outside of Babbitt, mm-hmm. near Ely, start of the Kuishwa River.
Mm-hmm.
And I took a week or more by myself there. So I was just with the water to write that.
Yeah.
The stories of the students I wrote at Mesa Refuge in California on a writing residency.
Mm-hmm.
Because I really needed a cradle, a community, somebody who believed that it was worth doing this. That was really painful.
Yeah.
Those are hard stories to carry, and they're extremely precious. So that was a good place to do it. I wrote the diabetes stuff right in my St. Paul house because I was close to my endo and knew I was safe.
Yeah.
it's where that happened. I think I wrote a lot of the things that are more teacherly mm-hmm. on the light rail and at Minneapolis College because mm-hmm. that's where I do that.
Yeah.
And then a really great editor I hired, Scott Edelstein, mm-hmm. looked at all the parts and said, weave them mm-hmm. or braid them. And that was fun.
Mm-hmm.
Cutting them up, putting them on the floor.
Yeah.
You know, the old way of putting things together when you see them all and you decide now a bit of this and now a bit of that.
Mm-hmm.
I made a quilt.
Yeah. It feels very visceral and present to be reading this book, so it is not surprising to me at all that you were doing it in the locales being referenced.
Mm-hmm.
I'm from northern Minnesota also. I'm from Duluth.
Oh, you are?
And it feels... sorry for the Annie tangent, but I was on the Superior Hiking Trail with some friends last week, and it just, the kind of intimacy and appreciation and feelings of the livingness of the water ecosystem mm-hmm. and of the tree ecosystem and stuff like that really comes through in this book, and it absolutely makes sense that you wrote it on site,
yeah.
so to speak.
And let the site write it.
Yes.
Because I think we Minnesotans, which mm-hmm. includes all of the newcomers who are also Minnesotans, no matter yeah. where they come from, mm-hmm. we gotta let this land speak through us because yeah. it's precious. I know all mm-hmm. land is precious, but they're each precious in their own way.
Yeah.
And we are the source of the water for much of this continent. And the people who were here before us and who are here now, the indigenous people who seem to get it more quickly than we white folks often do,
yeah.
know that we're water keepers.
Mm-hmm.
What the rest of the continent gets is what we pass through us.
Mm-hmm.
So speak it, Annie.
To talk a little more about kind of your process with students and working with young people, your ethos as a teacher was so present in this book. I loved everything you included about things you learned from your students, mm-hmm. conversations you had with your students, and kind of ways you got information and stories and learned really valuable things out of them. You show such a respect for your students with mutual learning, and you really indicate treasuring that knowledge. And I just wanted to ask for a little more about how your teaching informs your writing and the other way around.
Yeah. I hope that in the book I can give a bit of the experience of what it's like to be with a group of people for a semester. It is such a privilege. And maybe all the schools in Minnesota are like this, but what I know is Minneapolis College, and we've got these this great diversity.
Mm-hmm.
Native-born, foreign-born, and they have so much to teach. And it would be mm-hmm. such a waste if I thought I was the teacher.
Mm-hmm.
I am the co-learner.
Mm-hmm.
We exchange stuff. I've got privileges that I need to pass on.
Mm-hmm.
So from those I give, and then they've got privileges. I had no idea what it was like to live in the hood, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I got taught some really important lessons.
Mm-hmm.
And... yeah, so that is precious. I hope that in the book I welcome the reader in as you would be welcome to a class. So you hear the voices of many, many people who've come to me as, you know, they were officially students, but they're just other beings.
Mm-hmm.
And you hear their voices as you would fellow classmates.
Mm-hmm.
So that I hope you get the sense of you are in this group of beings. And then we let in also the beings of the trees and the other ones. Oh,
yeah.
That's my insulin pump. I will make it stop that noise.
It did feel free to have a snack if you need to. It did
yeah.
feel like being in a classroom setting. Like I took a really writing workshop intensive undergrad degree.
Mm-hmm.
So like it felt very natural to have people like speaking up and sharing things, and some people would share it sometimes and some people
yeah.
would share it other times. And just the way you really highlighted the learning opportunity of being in that room with people from different continents and from different ways they came here and all different ages. Like it's so rich that you get to learn from these people regularly, and it's cool that you bring that into your writing. When you're including your students in your writing, do you usually like discuss it with them, or
those who I had contact with? Still, I asked. A few of them wanted their names to be used, so there are a few real actual names of people in there because they wanted them. And others are compilations of people. And yeah, I hope it's all respectful of the students. It's, yeah, it was like that. I was thinking of, there are assignments in here, and I want readers to take them seriously. I know they don't have to, but students also didn't have to take me seriously. You know, I give them assignments, and they sometimes do it, sometimes they don't do it. But
yeah,
I think it's important to do it if you can, to actually stop in the reading and do this. I'm going to read the shortest one. It's called The Voice of the Body.
Yeah.
What just now is the nearest body trying to say? Yes, that one, the one that is you. Do you hear it? Will you be still and listen? And I have to say that to myself sometimes. You know, I didn't listen when I was dying of thirst. I thought I could psych myself out of it.
Yeah.
I thought I could tell myself to stop thinking about drought and I wouldn't be thirsty. And I needed to pay attention and go to an emergency room. So I really want people to recognize that this body is the same as this earth. We're not different. We're one thing. And listening to your own body also teaches you to listen to the other, the bigger body of the trees and the neighbors, bird neighbors and human neighbors and all of them.
Yeah. I don't want to speak for education in too broad of strokes, but in my own life, I've had some teachers who kind of discourage, like, just sitting and, like, you talk about, like, spending time with yourself, kind of spending time with a tree or a plant or things like that, and really sinking into that. But there are ways that kind of, like, go, 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 school culture that's always about studying for the next exam, studying for the big ACT or whatever, is something where you kind of have to parallel also be learning about how to listen to yourself or things like that, because I feel like that's a lesson that people are kind of asked to push aside in order to succeed in kind of the human-made society around us. And I really appreciated the ways the kind of the activity sections in your book, I'll refer to them, really brought that about. That's a skill that like I cultivated somewhat as a kid being surrounded by nature, but also like that's a skill that I really realized I lacked and really needed to have when I started to need more and more care for mental health stuff, mostly depression. And it's like, I didn't know how to listen to myself because I thought the right thing to do was to push that down.
Right.
And thinking about that relative to other things, thinking about that relative to climate change or to paying attention to the people around you to try to create a better society or things like that, the instinct to push through rather than to take a beat and listen is such a thing that needs to be practiced and used carefully. And I'm really glad that your book brought that about and that you shared that.
I think that our ecological crisis is going to bring that about. Either we'll do it or it will be done to us.
Yeah.
So the biggest change we need to make is you could use the word paradigm shift, but it's just like a noticing that we are not individuals and that achievement is not the thing.
Yeah.
You know, that we actually need to follow the cycles that are natural cycles and be part of the whole.
Yeah.
And that's what you're talking about. That's a bigger achievement than getting the degree that you might have to get maybe to stay alive, but maybe not.
Yeah. Yeah, I know so many people, myself included sometimes, who feel guilty about resting. But resting is such a vital part of listening to the environment around you, participating in the world around you, observing changes and things as they happen. While talking about like being present in what's going on around you where you are. You bring up in the book kind of the, like, I kind of think of it as like the climate shutdown, and you use the phrase climate distress, where when folks get in a conversation about climate change, they kind of get overwhelmed and feel like there's nothing to do, and they kind of shut down. And you kind of counter this climate distress, or at least you mention countering it in the book by saying you remind yourself you will live to see the return of the cold. And in another area, you talk about working with the soil. And in another area, you talk about advocating with Minnesota 350. I just think it's really important that this is brought up. And I just wanted to ask, what do you recommend to readers and thinkers who are experiencing climate distress? Kind of where to get started, mm-hmm. how to sit for a beat, and how to choose a reasonable amount of action that makes sense.
Yeah,
there's no one individual who is going to walk out of KFAI and then instantly solve climate change.
No,
that's
none of
not
us.
Real.
No, none of us, but all of us.
Yes.
I repeat in the book, the first thing to do is to stop, and the next thing to do is to breathe, mm-hmm. and then assess the situation. That's what I have to do also when I'm going low or high with diabetes.
Yep.
And the same is there. It's interesting you mentioned that sentence, you will live to see the return of the cold, because that was a sentence that came at me from out of the blue. Was it the voice of God? Was it my unconscious? Was it my wishes speaking? Mm-hmm. What would Freud say? Who knows? I don't know. But I heard it. And do I believe it? I wish.
Yeah.
Maybe. I think there can be miracles, like insulin mm-hmm. is sort of a miracle. It didn't come soon enough for many people.
Yeah.
But it came soon enough for me, mm-hmm. oddly, which is, yeah. So I do problematize this thing. I tell you what a tree said to me in the book. Mm-hmm. Did the tree really say that? Well, as much as I said it, or as much as I heard it, you know?
Yeah.
And I think it's okay to take comfort where we can get it.
Yeah.
But then also we need to take that little bit of comfort and do something. Scientifically, it is proven that working in the soil will help your depression. So mm-hmm. that one really I can say with assurance, mm-hmm. good thing to do. Joining with others, MIN 350, Minnesota Interfaith Power and Light, Climate Generation, whatever I'm part of, a transition town, whatever works for you, pick that thing and do something with that organization. If you have nothing else to give, give money. Mm-hmm. But most of us have a little bit of time, or you can listen to all their things, or you can support them, you can bring food to the volunteers if you can't volunteer or give money yourself. You could, you know, do something. Mm-hmm. But I think it's better to pick one than spread yourself too thin.
Yeah.
So do something like that.
Yeah.
It's tough. But as we talk about it, honestly, it gets not as awful.
Yeah.
It gets like, oh, really? I'm switching the way I look at life, mm-hmm. and it all is better. It's a wake up that we need,
mm-hmm.
and it'll improve other parts of life too.
There's one other quotation I want to talk about that I really love in this book. It's perhaps my favorite. You give the advice to use your energy to nourish others as well as yourself, but first learn who those others are and ask them what they need. When we force the aid we think is right on others, we violate them. And I just thought that was good advice in interpersonal, multicultural, environmental contexts. I think especially, I say this as a white person, I think a lot of white people think they know how to solve a lot of things when they yeah. actually should be having interracial and interfaith conversations about things before making decisions. And I was just wondering if you could talk to me about learning that and trying to work that ethos into this stories.
Yes, permaculture, and permaculture is not the term we should use, but regenerative agriculture, mm-hmm. whatever. When you come to your yard, before you try to take out all the turf grass and plant good things, you recommended to live with it for a year.
Mm-hmm.
See what grows. Mm-hmm. Listen to those things. Watch them. And when we're interacting with humans who are different from us, too, I think watching, listening, modeling, mm-hmm. I mean, sitting like they sit.
Yeah.
Comes before asking questions. And certainly before trying to help. Help should be like taken out of our little white vocabulary, if we can. But first, all of those things of being receptive, watching, listening, feeling, getting a psychic sense. Mm-hmm. And then before you do something, ask permission. And it's the same with people as for all the other people, the trees and the like. Mm-hmm. Before you pick something, ask. And as I heard a Indigenous Oneida elder, I think it was, say the other day, you know, you will look at the first one, but you don't take it, and you look at the second one, but you don't take it, and then the third one, you ask. And that's kind of the same, I think, for any group of beings.
Mm-hmm.
That find your own way, but those are some hints, anyway.
Yeah. Oh, I absolutely love that. Thank you. It hurts my heart to say this, but we're actually out of time. I really appreciate you coming and speaking with us tonight. This has been so much fun. For those who joined us partway through, this is Renee Lenar Hansen here talking about her new book, Watershed, Attending to Body and Earth in Distress. Thank you so much, Renee.
Thank you. And this chair squeaks. You probably don't know because I'm the first one to sit in it for a year. If you heard squeaks, it wasn't all my pump, folks.
Well, thank,
thank
you so
you.
Much.
It was great.
Yeah.
See
take
you.
Care.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Annie Harvey with Right On Radio, and I'm so excited to have Maggie Shipstead here today. Maggie's the author of several novels, most recently Great Circle. Maggie, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
For those who haven't had the chance to get their hands on the book yet, could you briefly describe what happens in it?
Yeah, absolutely. Great Circle is primarily about a fictional female pilot named Marion Graves, who disappears in 1950 while trying to fly around the world north-south over the poles. But it starts much earlier and goes through her childhood in Montana and learning to fly in the 20s there. She flies in Alaska in the 30s. She flies in the UK during World War II. And her story is interwoven with that of a modern-day movie star named Hadley Baxter, who's playing Marion in a biopic about her life and sort of gets drawn in the question of who Marion really was and what her disappearance kind of means.
This book has everything. Just picture Stefan on SNL. For anyone who hasn't read the book yet and is debating picking up a copy, there's lots of aviation, learning to fly, Old West moonshine bootlegging, Hollywood, tabloids, undercover queer romance, contemporary film stunts, family tragedy, secret children. The book is 600 pages, but to me it felt more like 300 because I was just flying through it. Things kept happening. With all this stuff going on, could you give me a little insight into your research process for this and how you used research to tell this story in a way that's so engrossing and feels so present?
Yeah, well, so I never plan my books. So when I started, I sort of thought that like my other books, I just sort of knocked this off in a year, which turned out to be extremely incorrect. It took 3 years and 3 months to write a first draft. And my first draft was 980 manuscript pages, which is about 25% longer than it ended up being.
Wow.
And I just kind of, I had, the only things I knew were Marion's route around the world, and I decided what kind of plane she would use. And I knew I wanted her to fly during World War II, but I didn't know if I would do that in the US or the UK. So I just sort of started, and then immediately I thought, well, I'll start with an ocean liner sinking or with the launch of an ocean liner. And so then I have to, you know, go get all these books about ocean liners and try and figure out why they sink. And then write that part and then move forward. And that's pretty much my research model throughout the book, was I would come up with some question that I didn't know the answer to or something I needed to write about. And then I would track down the information I needed and sort of use it. And then it kind of goes right out of my head. So it was really pretty organic. And then as I discovered or just came across bits and pieces while I was researching, that would then kind of drive the plot as well. Like there are plenty of left turns just because I came across something that interested me or seemed useful or appropriate. But yeah, it was, it just made it all feel like swimming upstream, because I'd make a little bit of progress and then I'd be like, now I have to figure out what Seattle was like in, you know, 1928 or whatever it was. And yeah, it was a lot of work.
That feels very true to the nature of the story, in that in the current day track, Hadley, unlike a lot of the people who are making the movie and are coming at things from such a prescriptive lens, like, oh, this is what Marion Graves was, this woman wrote this book about her and we're treating that as definitive for this movie, Hadley is so open and flexible to, like, knowing that she'll never know everything about Marion, or learning something about Marion and actually, like, believing and being relieved that the narrative is getting complicated and accepting those non-tight answers. Did you feel kind of like you were having a parallel experience when you were writing it, or did that ethos writing it play at all into your writing of Hadley's journey?
Oh, interesting. I'm sure subconsciously. I mean, I think I also didn't think through this when I sort of came up with Hadley, which was also semi-accidental. I think I'd been working for 3 or 4 weeks on the book, and then I wrote a section in the book where Hadley is publicly cheating on her movie star boyfriend with a pop star and walks out of a club. And on the surface, it had nothing to do with this aviation thing I was starting to work on, but I sort of felt like it was the missing piece. Mm-hmm. And I think one way in which that ended up being true is that Hadley has this, you know, long-term personal experience of people thinking they know her when they don't, you know, and seeing a picture of her doing something or being somewhere. And then this whole story gets constructed. All these wrong assumptions are made. They spread like wildfire. Mm-hmm. And so I think that in some ways predisposed her to look at the bits and pieces of Marion's life that she can find or has access to, and not think that she knows the whole story, or not, she, I think something in her resists sort of filling in the blanks as enthusiastically as everybody else does. And so that was one of the important things about her lens in the book, was just showing, you know, how much is lost when someone disappears or dies. And the reader has this close experience of Marion's life and knows almost about enough, as much about Marion as Marion does. And meanwhile, Hadley's like trying to, you know, assemble something out of those pieces, and the reader can see how in some ways futile it is. But, you know, I don't think, we never really know other people even when they're still alive. So,
yeah, that's so true. So just to dive into that a little deeper, I think that the voice work and the time work in this story was so fascinating and one of my favorite things about it, because you have the pretty immediate, close third person that's describing Marion's life. It feels like a very traditional novel. And then you have the Hadley perspective, which is feels more contemporary. The language is a little like very emotional, a little more sparse in a good way. Like I read through those sections like I was eating popcorn, but still felt them very much. And those together came into, you have a vantage in the past, seeing how things are. You have a vantage in our time, so the future for Marion, trying to decipher things. And the reader is in a fascinating space where they're holding a curated set of information that none of the characters do. Like, we know how Marion will be perceived in the future, but we also know a fair bit about how she felt in the moment. And I was just wondering, how did you, besides that experience you had writing Hadley walking out of the club, how did you choose film specifically and celebrity specifically as the future corollary to Marion's life, especially when there are so many ways to be a public figure in like the internet age, Hollywood very specifically?
Yeah, I mean, some of it was just interest. And I live in LA. And when I started writing the book, I had just moved here. Mm-hmm. And a lot of my friends work in Hollywood. And so it's just so pervasive, that culture in this city, which I find really fascinating. And I had also written a short story that was published in Tin House. I started writing Great Circle in fall 2014. And I think the previous year was when I published this story that was also sort of a intense first person voice of a movie star. And it was playing with sort of familiar tropes, or it was playing with the Katie Holmes, Tom Cruise story and with Scientology. But I sort of reinvented all the vocabulary, and I really enjoyed that process. I thought it was really interesting. I talked to Curtis Sittenfeld for a book event, and she was saying that she feels like when she's writing about public figures, like she's done with Hillary Clinton or Laura Bush, it's like she's talking to the reader about someone they both know, you know, as opposed to if you're talking to a friend and you're telling a story to your friend about someone they don't know, it really changes the feeling. And, yes. And I think that's true. I like sort of having the reader have a running start in the Hadley sections with these little bits and pieces that are sort of familiar and known. But I also think, you know, we get so much of our information about history and past figures through film and TV now, kind of for better or for worse. And I also, you know, I thought a lot about Amelia Earhart in starting the book, because she's sort of, there were many female pilots who were kind of household names in the 20s and 30s, but she's sort of the one we still remember. And it's less about her accomplishments, although they were major, than about her disappearance. I would bet everything I have that she crashed in the ocean and drowned. Like, there's no way anything else happened. But, you know, every few years, somebody digs up something so random and it goes viral, you know, a photo of nothing. And they're like, is this really what happened to Amelia Earhart? It's like, we know what happened to her. And so I think that sort of virality and that confusion of narratives also was indirectly what pushed me toward a Hollywood story. And even looking at, like, the way Amelia Earhart has sort of this game of telephone that happens culturally that conveys a person's life to sort of the general public, I think is really interesting.
Yeah, I would love to dive into the way that patriarchy is so pervasive, both in the Marion thread and in the Hadley thread. And something I really appreciated about this book is that you could say that gender dynamics have changed a lot over the duration of time between Marion's life and Hadley's life, which in some ways is very true. But on the other hand, it's very true that both of them had to interact with male gatekeepers and please male gatekeepers in order to have their career. I'll try not to spoil anything for those who haven't read, but to give a little context, Marion had kind of a patron to help her afford her flight teaching. And then Hadley had to deal with, I'll say it, she had to deal with some kind of greasy studio execs who did not behave especially well in order to get her roles. And I just thought that the way that there was that parallelism, yet also that difference in how patriarchal society prevents smart and capable women from achieving what they can do without that upward punch of male financial or industry patronage. I'll say male gatekeepers across time.
Yeah, male gatekeepers is a great phrase. You know, it kind of arose of its own accord. Like when I started to write the book, I didn't have any thoughts of like, this is how I will weave my feminist agenda into it. Although, of course, you know, I think a lot of it was just the practicalities of, okay, this woman or girl, a teenage girl in 1927, decides she wants to be a pilot. And she doesn't have, you know, wealthy, supportive parents. She's effectively orphaned. She's raised by her sort of semi-feral childhood, raised by her ne'er-do-well uncle. How do you become a pilot? And, you know, certainly there wasn't some structure of supportive female pilots like looking to help her out. And so she's trying to take lessons and all these men are like, no way, kid, you know? And so she realizes she needs to make money. And how do you do that? And again, that's hard as a girl. And so I think all these obstacles were very concrete and she had to apply a lot of ingenuity and make some very real sacrifices in order to find her way to this thing she knew she had to do. She had to be a pilot and would literally do anything and could kind of talk herself into like the relationship you mentioned with her patron. She sort of was like, this will be fine. I'll be able to get out of this when I need to. And it's a lot more complicated. And, you know, I think too, like in her time period, when she decided she didn't want a domestic life, she didn't want to get married and have children. That's not just one decision you can make. It's this endless series of choices she had to make throughout her life to sort of protect this unorthodox life. And she's constantly vigilant about it at the expense of human connection, even with people who didn't, you know, overtly want to take that away from her. And so then with Hadley, I mean, you can, as many people do as celebrities, can look at her and say, well, this is a, you know, extremely rich and famous young white woman. There, she has no problems, no obstacles. And sort of on a certain logistical level, that's true. But what's, you know, Hadley's big sort of problem is just the crushing weight of public scrutiny and how you can never do anything right. Like you can't perform womanhood correctly. You're supposed to be sexy, but not have sex. You're supposed to be interesting, but not be sort of this wrecking ball that she is a little bit. And she's also, I mean, yeah, as you mentioned, it's, for an actress, there's incredible pressure on your body to live up to this male gaze. You mentioned she has sort of a, what we'd now call a Me Too moment with a Harvey Weinstein-esque, not even quite, a much less demonic movie producer. But I think I wrote that before the Weinstein story broke, and I've gotten asked about it a lot. And it's like, well, one of the things about Harvey Weinstein is like, even people who had no connection to the film industry already knew that guy was like a monster. Like, I think it was a huge bombshell that took journalistic tenacity like nobody's business, but nobody was surprised. Mm-hmm. You know, casting couch jokes have been around forever. And in some ways it reminds me of the Catholic Church abuse scandals, where it's like altar boy jokes have been around forever. Like, people have always known this. It's been in, sort of in the ambient culture. And then at a certain point, like, things break and it comes out. So yeah, I think Hadley, yeah, her problems are different than Marion's, but I think that they're both just kind of fundamentally grappling with, like, how do I make my life the way I want, being also being a woman? And it's never not complicated.
That segues really nicely into something else that I wanted to ask you about in kind of the women's history section of how I perceive this book. Both Hadley and Marion in their own ways are given much higher kind of quote unquote moral standards to meet in life than men in their communities. They're kind of expected to uphold good behavior as they get increasing amounts of attention and also meet the needs of the men in their life while also being groundbreaking, doing what they do. So they're often blamed for the mistakes of the men that have equal or greater culpability for what has happened. Like, for example, Hadley's affair that kind of imploded the perfect dating situation in which she was dating her movie co-star, or Marion being blamed for her husband's alcoholism instead of, I don't know, acknowledgement that alcoholism is its own thing. For this kind of women as moral benchmarks phenomenon, how did that play into your story crafting process and your research?
Yeah, that's so interesting. I mean, I don't think I've thought about it, but I think it's very true. I think some of it is, you know, men are still very much treated as like the default human experience. And so, of course, men face criticism and judgment and reprobation, all these things. But I don't think it's often in the context of like, well, that's because you're a man, or like, you're not a man, right? And I think that's kind of always lurking for women. It's like in the equation at all times. Marion's uncle, who raises her, is just a complete and total mess. He's like a degenerate gambler. He's an artist. He has a drinking problem. But I think the way he is perceived, even in that community in the 20s in Montana, is different from how, say, the mother of Marion's best friend, Caleb, is treated, who's also has a drinking problem and is a prostitute. So, yeah, I don't know. It wasn't a big part of my thought process, but I think, you know, just so much about the female experience, once you start writing about women, it finds its way in.
Yeah. To change topics a fair bit, there are a lot of history of aviation benchmarks in addition to a lot of information about planes that Marion wanted or was interested in flying, the World War II planes. How did planes become kind of a central meat of the story, and how did you craft them in a way that felt very present?
Yeah, I'd never been big into airplanes. My brother just left the Air Force after 20 years, and he hasn't flown for a while, but he was a pilot in the Air Force. He flew C-130s. And as a child, he was just obsessed with airplanes, and he could tell what kind, you know, was flying over. He knew everything about them. And I think a lot of people who are pilots just know it's just this thing, like, I must be a pilot. And I never felt that. So when I started writing the book, I had a fair amount of anxiety about, like, can I write about pilots? And I thought about taking flying lessons, and sort of fundamentally, I did not want to. I have like sort of poor spatial relations. None of it's intuitive to me. I thought it would be sort of scary. It's very expensive. But I did go on rides in airplanes when I could. And so, like, I went in a glider and did a loop, which sort of informed how Marion describes flying a loop. And I landed on glaciers and ice sheets. And I was in Missoula once and at the Aviation Museum. And just by chance, these two guys were taking up a 1927 Traveler 6000. And they were like, tell that lady, she can come too.
Ooh.
And I was like, okay. And so, you know, that was completely serendipitous. And I made that the kind of plane that Marion learns how to fly, because I'd ridden around in it in the exact place where she was learning. So I'd seen the site and I, you know, heard it and smelled it and I had video of it. But the more I, you know, and I read lots of books by pilots and about pilot, and I used, you know, internet resources like YouTube as well. But, you know, the more I learned about aviation, the more kind of moving I found it, just the speed at which this technology changed the world. And an example I think of all the time is, you know, Charles Lindbergh flew across the Atlantic in 1927 in sort of a glorified laundry basket. And you know, it was this world event and parades, and he's the most famous person in the world. Just this one flight, you know, that's now so ordinary to us. And within his lifetime, he was present at the launch of Apollo 11. So he was there for the moonshot. That shift just in one human lifespan, I think, is really sort of awe-inspiring. As were just kind of those early pilots, they're so adventurous. Reading about them is also a way to see how much the world has changed. Like, they would just sort of land wherever, just in a desert, and hope for the best. And just the wildness of the planet is something that I thought about a lot too.
Yeah. Again, trying not to spoil for folks who haven't read yet, but they land in Antarctica. They're all over Europe. There's so much going on in here, and all of the flight scenes feel very tangible. They feel like a real experience. And flight felt to me like it was the perfect linking force between Marion and Hadley, because they have pretty different personalities, but they're both free thinking, they're autodidactic, they're really avid at doing things on their own, be it reading, exploring, and they both have relationships to tragedies without being defined by their tragedies. And it just felt like solo aviation still has that kind of adventurous connotation even today. And it felt like such a good link.
Thanks. Yeah. You know, I will say one of the hardest, possibly the hardest thing in the revision phase after I'd written my first draft was sort of how to connect these two characters. And so I was always looking for ways to do that. And through my drafts, I strengthen the sort of concrete coincidences they have, like they're both orphans, they're both raised by uncles. And it was less about doing anything cutesy and more just about creating a reason why Hadley would sort of look at Marion as having something to do with her. Like, I think Hadley is fundamentally a self-absorbed person, as she inevitably would be growing up as a child actor. And she thinks the universe is sending her messages, and this is one. But I had different versions. You know, there was a draft where Hadley and this producer she works with, Redwood, are like in a library, like going through files and like digging up stuff on Marion. But that was like too sort of on the nose and literal. And, and so, it was this sort of kind of the last thing that fell into place with the book, was having enough, but not too much Hadley, and having their connection be close enough, but not too tidy. So I think flight, or even just a sort of a metaphorical sensation of flight, was something I was sort of trying to put in there.
Yeah, it felt to me like the connection between Hadley and Marion came out balanced really nicely. And then I think they each had nice foils within their own lives. Like, I really enjoyed the parts about Jamie. For those who haven't read, Marion has a very pacifistic, exploratory brother who doesn't really understand her, but participates in her life and goes on his own adventures. And it feeds really nicely into her story. For revising this book down hundreds and hundreds of pages, is there anything that you wish could have been in or could have been done differently? Or do you feel like you came down to something that you really feel settled on? That may be a weird question, and feel free to take it where you want.
No, not at all. I mean, I think part of the reason I'm able to publish books is that at a certain point I go, okay, this is done. And then I don't really let myself second guess it. So I cut 230 manuscript pages. And most of that was done doing small pervasive cuts. just a book that long, you cut a little bit on each page and you end up cutting a lot of pages. There was one section that we cut that I miss. I think it was absolutely the right decision to cut it. But there are these sections called incomplete histories, you know, that zip through sort of long periods of time. And there was one for Antarctica, but it came very late in the book, right before their flight. And my editor was like, you know, people have read 500 pages, aren't going to be excited when it's like Pangea, you know, and goes back millions of years. And you're like, oh, I just want to know what happens. I don't want to know about the movements of the tectonic plates. So that one I miss a little bit. There was also, Jamie had a different storyline for a while that involved him joining a religious community in Canada called the Dukhobors. And they're sort of like Russian Quakers. They're communal, they're pacifists, they're vegetarian, they're Christian, but don't use the Bible. It's all sort of sung prayer, really interesting people. And my editor was like, this is just one sort of weird thing too many. So that got cut. And then I had to sort of reconstruct his plot line. But yeah, I think, you know, it's just nothing's ever perfect. And, you know, no one ever wishes they published a book sooner, like an earlier draft. The thought of that horrifies me. And I'm sure I could have done more. But also it was like, it's now been 7 years since my last book was published. And it was just, you know, it was time.
Yeah,